Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff, and it's so great to have you with me today. This has been a really great day for me. I spoke today to the Brookline Rotary Club about VHL and about rare diseases in general and where to find help if you have a rare disease to deal with. You know, one person in 10 is dealing with a rare disease. So as I looked out over the audience, and there were about 40 people in the room, and I said, that means that there are about 4 people in this room who themselves have a rare disease, and maybe you know its name, and maybe you don't know its name, because getting a diagnosis of a rare disease is in itself a major challenge. So we're going to talk today about another rare disease, and let's see if I can pronounce its name. It's fondly known as LAM because it's pretty hard to diagnose. It's about a 14-foot name called lymphangioleiomyomatosis. So we'll call it LAM. It's much simpler that way, and you can find the fully spelled out name in the handout if you want to go find it there. So we're going to talk with Amy Farber, who is the executive director of the LAM Treatment Alliance, and I think that you'll find her a very fascinating person and a really nice lady to be dealing with. I want to tell you a little bit about your sponsor. This program is brought to you by the VHL Family Alliance. It's the alliance of families, researchers, and physicians who deal with von Hippel-Lindau disease. VHL is one tiny little misspelling in one little gene, and it results in an increased risk of tumors in many parts of the body. Retina, brain, spinal cord, kidney, pancreas, and adrenal glands. So that's called a syndrome. There's a number of different body parts that are affected. And if you know that what you have is part of a syndrome, then you know to watch out for issues in other parts of the body. So we're able to monitor to make sure that we're going to find problems early. In working with VHL over the last 40-some years, what I've learned is that you have to stay on top of whatever your risk factors are, work with your body, support your body in staying as well as possible, and that means advocating for yourself with your physicians. Not every doctor is going to understand about rare conditions. That's an understatement. And so you're going to need to work with your doctor, and hopefully your doctor is going to be willing to learn with you and help you optimize your health. So we're going to have a tiny little word from our sponsor here, and we'll be right back to talk with you some more. Hang on, and we'll be right back.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Hi, I'm Joyce Graff, the host of The Powerful Patient. For some 40 years, I've worked with people with von Hippel-Lindau disease, a tiny misspelling in one gene, the VHL gene, that causes tumors in 6 different areas of the body. Why these areas? What do they have in common?
Interestingly, as we study VHL, we're learning about what causes cancer for everyone. The VHL gene is on the main superhighway for tumor development in many cancers. The answer we need for VHL is part of the answer we need for all. Won't you help us find a cure for cancer? People with VHL are donating their tissue and their blood to move this forward. Won't you please donate some money to help? Please give at VHL.org. We want to make VHL stand for Very Happy Life. That's VHL.org. Thank you.
Hi there, it's Joyce Graff. We're back, and Amy's been delayed a little bit, but she's supposed to join us here in just a minute. We're hoping that Amy is going to join us as soon as possible because we're on the air and waiting for her to arrive. So let's talk a little bit about having a rare disease in general. I just was attending a rare disease program in Washington, a summit meeting for all rare diseases, and we're trying to find ways of treating them. And it's really interesting to see that while it's hard to get the attention of a pharmaceutical company on a particular disease and the aspects that are important to that disease, but we are learning more from the rare diseases than we learn in the general population every day. One of the doctors pointed out that, you know, you wouldn't on purpose go delete a gene and expect to see what was going to happen to this human being if you took the gene away. And yet with the rare diseases, that is what we see. We sort of have a laboratory experiment, if you will, that here's what happens to the body when this one gene is malfunctioning. And what that does is teaches us, oh, if that's because of that gene, then maybe if we see this condition in the general population, if we know that it may well be because of the lack of some protein or some other function of that gene or something along what's called the pathway, the sort of sequence of events that occurs. If one thing is not working exactly right, then what else might be going wrong? Then we can learn a very great deal from that and hopefully get some very good information on what to do for people who are suffering from that condition throughout the general population. It doesn't just have to be about people with this rare disease. So one of those rare diseases is lymphangiomyolipomatosis. Amy, are you there? Did I massacre that? Would you do that again for us?
Sure. Lymphangiomyolipomatosis.
Okay, so lymph, I understand. Angio means the vessels that carry the lymph around in our bodies, right?
Blood.
What's the rest of it? Can you decode that for us?
Sure. So the angio refers to blood, the blood vessels, and blood. And so there's a blood component to what's going on, or a vascularized component. There's some nutrients flowing around in the form of blood. Lyo refers to fat. So there's a fatty component. And then myo refers to muscle.
Uh-huh.
Lymphangiomyolipomatosis. And then mitosis. Mitosis is my understanding of mitosis is referring to some proliferative aspect of the process. But again, the disease was named in the late 1800s. So the descriptive type of name reflects, in some ways, some really early insights, and in some ways, a lack of knowledge.
Right. VHL is sometimes called angiomatosis for the same reason. I think the ptosis part is it kind of gets out of control and takes over.
Sounds right.
Yeah. Okay. So, well, the people who are dealing with LAM, let's just call it LAM from here forward.
Yes.
It's pretty hard to deal with that big moniker. But so tell us about LAM and about how you got interested in LAM.
Sure. Thanks so much for doing this. Your program and your focus is so important. So LAM I was diagnosed with LAM. I'd always been extremely healthy, and I studied science and technology studies, so I was interested in how research happened. I was actually focused on HIV/AIDS and diseases that affected large populations of people. I was about to start a family. I had finished a PhD and I was in law school, and I had vague discomfort in my upper abdomen and pulling feeling between my shoulder blades. I was in Boston and being seen at one of the Harvard affiliated hospitals, but even so, there were some early diagnostic testing that came back completely normal, and then I increasingly felt like, hey, something's not right. And then after a lot of testing, we had a suggested diagnosis of LAM based on small scattered cysts in my lungs and a lesion, a very small tumor-looking thing next to one of my kidneys. So the suspected diagnosis was this lymphangioleiomyomatosis, and as I would learn that LAM is a rare and fatal multi-system disease usually affecting women in their childbearing years, but almost exclusively affecting women and really being more sex-specific than breast cancer. Hmm. So LAM is tends to be fatal in the lungs, but women with the disease can progress to respiratory failure as the cysts and nodules take over normal lung from during a period of, gosh, could be as little as 2 years from diagnosis, or it could be over 10 or 20. So there's a lot of variability.
There was little known about this disease when you were diagnosed, which was how long ago was your diagnosis?
So I was diagnosed in April of 2005, and certainly there was relatively little going on in Boston where I was. And I had to go, so I ended up going to the NIH Clinical Center in Bethesda, Maryland, where they saw the largest cohort of patients with this disease. They had an observational protocol there in order to get a more definitive diagnosis. There was more than a little bit of research going on, but a lot of it, interestingly, focused on this one known gene defect in the disease. The gene defect was a defect that's very, very common in common cancers. And so that defect tended to be garnering a lot of the attention in the field and sort of taking on a life of its own, you could argue, without necessarily making the connections or asking the questions about what other genes are involved, what is the lymphatic part of the disease, how are the lymphatics involved, how do we really understand the relationship between, let's say, a cell with a particular gene defect and the lung destruction that causes the morbidity and mortality in the disease and in the women. So there was a lot of work to be done, but there was great curiosity about this, you know, this tumor suppressor related gene and the pathways related to that.
So which gene is that?
That's a TSC1 and 2 gene.
Okay, so these are the genes associated with tuberous sclerosis, which is another.
Exactly. So the interesting thing is, tuberous sclerosis complex is a disease that's, I think it affects 1 in 6,000, and that affects boys and girls, women and men, and it's a germline mutation, so it's seen as heritable, passed down. And it's a multi-system disease as well, but it tends to have a lot more neurological involvement than LAM. And 40% of the girls who have tuberous sclerosis complex get pulmonary LAM.
Hmm.
Now there's a sporadic kind of LAM where you don't have that underlying tuberous sclerosis complex defect in every cell of your body at the germline level. And in that case, you get these cells with this mutation and perhaps other mutations, and perhaps, you know, other things that we're not yet looking at, which bring about the lung destruction.
Hmm. So it might be something sort of downstream of the TSC gene.
It might be something downstream or parallel. I mean, it might be one or more other defects. It certainly could be, it could be upstream, downstream.
Right, and just to get everybody else into the conversation, when we say downstream, what we mean is there's a series of things that may go wrong. If A goes wrong, then B is likely to go wrong, and B is likely to push on C, and that kind of thing.
Right.
And when we say downstream, we're talking about something like C in that line picture.
Yeah.
But whereas if it were in parallel, then unconnected to A, B, or C, there's something else going on, like a 1-2-3 that's going in parallel.
Yeah. So there, you know, some people think that there are very few when we take our cue from cancers and cancer-like syndromes. I mean, it's not clear that there are many single gene defect diseases where that's really the whole story.
Right.
So I think. So we're really busy focusing and rounding out the picture, even though, you know, so that trying to put in proper perspective the meaning of this known gene defect.
Right.
And as you bring new people into the field, the issue is, you know, oftentimes, you know, how do you grow a field in order to accelerate research? And as we focus on that, it's really important to understand the progress that's been made and to pay deference to it, but without making it into an orthodoxy that can't be questioned or challenged. Because I think it's really important to keep the field open and alive. And I know that many of the scientists who are working on these feel that way. And it's just it's an artful exercise to try and.
Right. Right. And this is one of those problems when people go and say, well, I want Congress to appropriate $6 million to work on my disease. And when you earmark funds like that, you sometimes close more doors than you open, because not realizing that, as you say, it may not be all about one gene or one disease, but the learning that we get from a group of things could enrich all of them.
Yeah, I think that I am a huge believer based on my academic training prior to this was really focused on sort of interdisciplinary learning and how outcomes and solutions and ideas are strengthened by bringing more, you know, problem solvers into the mix. And it's tough. There's a lot of initiation, a lot of an engineering that you need to do to address the sociology. The sociological factors that come into doing that, especially if you're working in academia with academic partners from different silos or different fields that are, you know, each need each other in order to come out with, you know, a stronger understanding of a complex biological problem.
Right. So you obviously shifted your focus from HIV/AIDS to LAM. And how have you spurred research in this area?
So, great question. I'm just in awe. It turns out there are so many of us, you know, who've been thrust into the rare disease research arena. And the inspiring thing is that, you know, we find the disciplines and the research fields where they are when we come along, and we each grapple with accelerating the pace of research in different ways, and we all end up learning from each other. And so one of the things that I've been focused on has been growing, you know, making sure that the infrastructure that you just don't see and you sort of take for granted, the infrastructure for accelerating research is in place. So first and foremost, a transparent, effective, tissue banking and so procurement and distribution system is in place. Those kind of prerequisites for making research move faster are just essential. So that's the kind of infrastructure building. Create platforms, partnering with the MIT Media Lab, for instance, to create platforms for data sharing and for patients to participate in in their own discovery about their own disease and other patients' disease, and in direct conversation with researchers who otherwise don't have direct access to patients. And so piloting LAMSIGHT, LAMSIGHT.org right now to really make a dent there. The other side of that is a clinician, we're a clinician platform, so an international registry where clinicians around the world can enter data into a space that is accessible to researchers. With rare diseases, it's so important. You always hear, there aren't enough patients, but until you make a really good faith effort in using the strength of global technology today to enable patients and clinicians to aggregate their data with the proper incentives in place to really motivate all the different stakeholders, that's essential to progress as well. Raising money is really important, but it's not enough. You know, really working on prioritizing a research agenda so that you can be really smart about how you use your dollars and really strategic in making decisions about how the different research streams should interact. What should the process be? What should the timelines be? What should the deliverables be? What should contracts look like? You know, really making business decisions about science in order to motivate progress and create the fertile ground for discovery.
Yeah, thank you. You made a tremendous number of really good points in there, so I want to just go over a couple of them to make sure everybody caught them. One of the things the National Cancer Institute has been grappling with recently is really looking at, are they funding the right projects in order to bring real solutions to real people to the bedside, get things out of the lab and into clinical practice. And what they discovered when they looked at it is that they're funding a tremendous number of wonderful projects of basic science.
Right.
But then there are a bunch of cogs in the wheel that aren't there to get that into the clinic.
Right.
So you really have to look at the whole process. And as you say, map it out as if it were a manufacturing project or something like that. And
like a supply chain.
Bring it to market.
Absolutely. And if you start at your end game, I would absolutely concur that there are so many interesting intellectual questions along the way that, especially with basic science, there are going to be endless opportunities to get distracted and ultimately perhaps to benefit patients. But if you're really thinking about patients living with diseases today, it's important to grapple with the really difficult questions of how do you what are the partnerships that lead to the best progress in the discovery area? And then on your engineering challenges, who are the best partners there? And how do you create the fertile grounds for those projects? And those are difficult issues to grapple with.
Right. And it's not, of course, all about basic science. Ultimately, what we need is a drug that will just come in and magically make it all go away. But that's not going to, I mean, realistically, that's not going to happen for decades. So, I mean, even if we had a drug in hand tomorrow, it would take, 5 to 10 years to get it approved?
So that's based on a certain paradigm.
Okay.
A couple points. First of all, the point about repurposing. So with a lot of drugs that are untreatable today, it's not clear that a combination of existing FDA-approved drugs would not do the trick to either buy time or save lives. So that's one thing. Right now, just today even, there was this great press release about Trend, this new really great initiative coming out of the National Chemical Genomics Core at the NIH, really focusing on therapeutics and really working with, from our own experience, I can say it's really our experience was focused on all FDA-approved drugs and doing screens for the FDA-approved drugs that you wouldn't have to wait for further development in order to go ahead and get integrated into trials. So the repurposing issue of taking existing drugs, that's something that is especially relevant to rare diseases where a lot of times the candidate drugs that are already approved haven't been tested or piloted.
Right. because they're already on the market. So obviously we're past the, we know about their safety factors, for example. That's been well tested. Now we just have to find if they're effective for Lyme, right?
Exactly, or in any disease. So then the issue, then you have other issues. You have issues, how do we run clinical trials in rare diseases that don't take forever, cost exorbitant amounts of money, and require way too much patients.
Right. So, I mean, there some estimates it costs something like $800 million to bring a drug to market. And obviously, if there are only 100 affected people in the United States, that's not an economically viable proposition.
Right. But even in a repurposing situation, you're going to have the challenges of too few patients to get a statistically significant result, taking too much money and taking too much time. So thinking creatively about those issues has to happen even before, you know what drug candidates you want to use in your trial. Now is the time when all of us in these communities are really doing, hard work to think about what are creative new strategies for doing smaller, faster trials with really informative results. And so that is really important for each community to figure out, what kinds of trials can we do, what kinds of new trial designs from oncology are relevant to us.
Tell us a little about smaller factor trials. What does that mean?
So smaller, faster trials.
Oh, faster.
Faster, yeah, it's exactly what it sounds like.
Right, smaller, faster trials. So, yes, exactly. So it takes fewer people, it takes less time to figure out whether this thing is going anywhere or not.
Correct. And a lot of that has to do with having biomarkers. So if you can, in your disease, if you can tell if something's working faster based on some readout of some kind of indicator, the classic example is PSA test for prostate cancer.
Some blood test or urine test or something like that where you can
measure. Or even imaging.
Right.
Yeah.
You can measure some chemical or you can measure some image and see whether you're getting anywhere.
Yeah, even a combination of those is probably more realistic. But in some diseases, if you have got a tumor, a solid tumor, then you may not have this problem as much because oftentimes, let's say, the tumor will tell you what you want to know. But in diseases where you don't have a solid tumor, you're going to struggle more with these less quantitative indicators of response to treatment.
Right. Classically, they would look at that tumor and say, did it get bigger or smaller? But now what they've started doing is looking at, for example, the blood flow inside the tumor and see whether it's dying from the inside out. Because so sometimes they can see that it may still be the same size, but there's no activity inside. It's not metabolizing glucose or it's not chugging a lot of blood. It's really dead inside.
So more sensitive measures. That's great. Yep.
Right. So there's new measures even for tumors. But as you say, for something like, give us an example from Lyme of one of the things that you're looking at as a biomarker.
So it would be like vascular endothelial growth factor D, so VEGF-D, often associated with lymphatic involvement in cancer, high levels of this in blood, in patient blood, that this could potentially be some indicator that might be correlated with disease severity of progression. So if you saw that number, so there are two issues. One is, does that marker correlate with the disease at all? And then the second issue is, does that change when you try and modulate it or change it via some treatment or intervention?
Right. So it may have changed, but does that really mean that the disease is getting any better?
Or worse,
we have to figure that out. And then we have to make sure that, in fact, when we do this treatment, it's going to change in a way that gives us a real reliable readout on whether the treatment's working.
Yeah, so it's usually the likelihood is if you'll have a combination of these rather than one that you solely rely on, which is like the jackpot. There are people that say that rare diseases, something that I think about a lot these days, especially in regard to the issue of drug development, there are people that say, scientists that say that in fact rare diseases or common diseases are actually aggregated rare diseases. For instance, that actually breast cancer, we think of breast cancer as one disease, but in fact it's actually made up of a bunch of different rare breast cancers.
Right.
And that, you know, like estrogen receptor positive breast cancer and inflammatory breast cancer are really two diseases that are totally separate and are going to respond to different therapeutic interventions. And that if we think of it as common diseases that way, that it's really inspiring to think about what the rare disease can teach even the common disease groups about how you mobilize research into your rare disease, how you potentially fast track some of the strategies and facilitate collaboration, et cetera. But on the drug development front, what's interesting is that maybe when we start to think about one, Luke Hantley says that that maybe if we would just think about drug targets rather than diseases, if we just looked at different diseases, no matter how big, how many people affected, and tried to identify the defects and the druggable targets that were relevant to those diseases, that it might be a more rational way of developing drugs, because you then are really thinking about the end game. You're thinking about what targets you have in each disease. You're not thinking about does this particular disease have enough people to justify a treatment. You're thinking across diseases.
Right.
At common target.
Really good. Yeah, there are a number of targets that I see on the charts in kidney cancer, and TSC is actually on some of the charts for kidney cancer. And as you say, if we have druggable targets, we could say, well, for this disease, we need to add A, B, and C together, and for that disease, we need D, E, and F, and have sort of cocktails of things that that apply to these various targets.
Exactly. It's a wonderful phrase also that Vicky Sato used recently, that what if we thought of rare diseases not as cul-de-sacs, but as the thin edge, what is it, the thin edge of a wedge? So it's really as a window onto how we're looking at all diseases.
That's neat. The thin edge of a ledge, and just kind of looking at through this prism, if you will, or a window onto all diseases. Which ones do we see from this angle? Which ones do we see from that angle? Did I get that right?
Yeah, I think she's thinking wedge, like more that this is our point of entry. This is our important point of entry, helping us to see how we should be looking at all diseases. That we should be seeing all these diseases as these individual little diseases. One strong argument is that when you realize or when you try and understand why drugs don't make it to market and why it's so expensive to bring drugs to market, oftentimes it's because you have the failure rates are high. And if you properly stratified, one argument is that if you properly stratified the patient populations who were in any particular trial properly based on these sub-classifications of common diseases, that you would get higher success rates.
I have a friend who worked actually on leukemia this way, that they noticed that each drug for leukemia, and there are quite a few of them, but they would only help about 15% of the children who took them. So if you started a child on drug A and it didn't help, and then you tried drug B and it didn't help, and you tried drug C and it didn't help, by this time the kid is dead. So you're going to run out of time. So what they really needed was something to help them figure out which drug was going to be the right one and give that one to him first.
Absolutely.
So they worked out, by doing gene arrays, they were able to say children with a gene pattern that looks like this need drug D. And they've been actually pretty successful in doing that for leukemia. So it is possible to do it, but of course we have a lot more kids with leukemia, unfortunately, than we have with many of the rare diseases.
True, but so we can start in the diseases we say, oh, we don't have enough people. You know, start by ensuring that all of these fields have a non, you know, a an affordable way to aggregate data globally, right? Like the minimum we should be doing is getting our data together because, you know, we're stronger in numbers. And so it's easy to say we don't have enough patients, but it's hard to say, okay, well then every single patient must be, you know, aggregated into this common resource where we can then stratify in a meaningful way. And,
right.
And
I mean, in order to do that study, they only used like 100 or 200 kids with leukemia and did gene arrays on them, because at the time the gene arrays were more than $1,000 a pop. Now they're getting less and less expensive. So we should be able to, as you say, aggregate 50 or 100 people and do a gene array, and just that kind of data, if you put that into one of the big computers at MIT, we should be able to learn some interesting things.
Yeah. So we start, you know, thinking collectively, you know, and then not having to reinvent the wheel for each of these diseases, right? There are a lot of common platforms, database platforms that we can use and just customize slightly. But really, we should all be spending our time, you know, thinking about the hard questions and not reinventing the wheel, so we can do better on the front. And that's where I'm super excited to make some progress. I think we can all learn so much from each other, and we all have these common challenges, even if we come from, you know, if the diseases are so different.
Right, the diseases are different, but some of this methodology we can definitely share, just like, you know, looking at those genetic profiles and saying, okay, what are the commonalities, what are the differences? Do we have, as you say, three strata of people or two strata of people, or what? How do they seem to break down, and what are the differences? And just learning that can be a big breakthrough.
Absolutely, and using patients more smartly, you know, for children, and educating patients about how they can get involved, not just in fundraising, but definitely in being part of the research process in a virtual way.
Right. So you mentioned researchers can't do much of anything without tissue to study, without information to compile, either clinical data
mm-hmm.
or genetic profiling kind of data.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I know one of the things that you've worked on hard is to make sure that you're collecting tissue from patients. Can you tell us some about that?
So, yeah. So that's something we have in common, because that's I think, how we first met.
That's right.
The National Disease Research Interchange, based in Philadelphia, has been, starting in 2006 for LAM, has been a really proactive and engaged partner in a highly technical effort to both register donors, tissue donors or patients, to do that in a proper, you know, a proper and ethical way, first domestically and then around the world. And then on the other hand, to get the researchers to sign up and register with their particular research protocols and their very specific technical needs on the specifics of what kind of tissue they need and how it should be preserved. The art and the science associated with this, really what is one-stop shopping at the NDRI, you know, to really coordinate this really intricate dance of getting fresh do in many cases, often in the middle of the night, from patients to research labs, up to, you know, a dozen research labs on call waiting for fresh tissue on weekends, the middle of the night, really doing a beautiful job coordinating that and you know, when things don't work out, really learning from experience and being really willing and eager to do better and to expand into Europe on a pilot program because there was a need to make sure that tissue wasn't being thrown away. They've just been really amazing and outstanding, you know, partners, really in the true sense of the word partner.
Right, and because of the partnership, you didn't have to reinvent that wheel. You were able to utilize the base of information and expertise and facilities that they have accumulated over the last 25 years.
Exactly. It's the beautiful thing about it. No reinventing wheels, you know, leveraging expertise, and then their incredible willingness to help particularize their expertise to the new features that a new disease would introduce. So
they're just. So in part, they're a kind of matching service. They take the very specific requirements of a research project and try to make sure that the tissue is collected in a way that's going to be useful to that researcher and match them up.
Absolutely. They have just tremendous respect for the need to have tissue in order to make science move, and they get that you know, you have to really follow the recipes, the required preparation recipes that each researcher requires in order to then lead to an important result that can bring move research forward.
Right, and as you say, tissue needs to be acquired as soon as possible after it's been removed. So whenever there's a surgery or a death, we need to respond very quickly in order to get it into the bank in a usable format for research.
Yeah, or out to the researchers that same, you know, fresh. So there's a middle of the night activity and really heroic efforts and a steep learning curve in some ways because there's so many institutions involved.
Right. Now, I know some people are a little skittish about donating tissue because of they're concerned that the body won't be available in time for the funeral and so forth. Can you say anything about that?
Gosh, in LAM, I can actually speak better to the fresh tissue procurement from both fluid, so that's from the lymphatic fluid that's now become so important for research, and also the tissue that comes more often, though not exclusively, from tissue donors who are receiving a lung transplant. Now, lung transplants aren't a treatment or a cure in LAM, but they do help to buy some time, and they can be life prolonging, although they're incredibly risky surgeries. So in that case, you have a patient who's going to potentially receive new lungs, and their old lungs are the ones that will get shipped out to donors.
Right, so, and that transplantation sometimes happens in the middle of the night because the new lungs become available whenever they become available, and again, we have to respond ASAP.
Yeah, no, it's dominantly 2 in the morning and weekends and holidays. That's when it happens, and it's almost predictably so.
Yeah, but we're very glad, and I hope that everybody will sign that donor registration card at the automobile registry because, God forbid, you should be in an accident. You could really make life a lot different and much better for a lot of people.
Absolutely. And the interesting thing is, you know, in countries where you do have either more donors or you have access to different types of tissues in LAM, what we see is we just see how research really thrives. You have access to unique specimens or when you have access to earlier stage tissue, for instance, you know, end-stage lung disease is not always the most informative. We need, you know, tissue from early on as well, and the field really struggles there. In places like Japan, however, we do get earlier tissue biopsies, which is different from the U.S., and you can see that really enhances the understanding of the pathophysiology of the disease.
Why do we not get them from the U.S.?
Well, it's a risk-benefit calculation about, you know, what is the risk to the patient, potential risk to the patient, if they're at the earlier stage of the disease, you know, is it going to create problems for them to do a tissue biopsy as opposed to trying to make a diagnosis in a, you know, through some surrogates, either through imaging, through circulating cells. So the definition or the diagnostic criteria right now in the United States for LAM doesn't say that the gold standard or the standard is to do a tissue biopsy.
Okay, so in order to get a diagnosis of LAM and know that we're dealing with LAM and not something else, you're able to do it with imaging and with some blood testing?
So, yeah, usually it's a lot of confirmatory kind of imaging. The criteria is, for instance, to have, you know, these cysts that really image, you know, like we would expect in LAM, plus one other feature associated with the disease, but outside of the lungs. So you'll either have the kidney lesion I described earlier, or you'll have, let's say, evidence of tuberous sclerosis complex, or you'll have, there are a couple of other features. If we could get a specific biomarker for LAM, we don't have this now, you could also test for that and say that the whole picture, even if you don't have a tissue biopsy, the whole picture looks so much like LAM. And then you do the circulating cells, let's say, and you can validate that these are what we think are LAM cells. Then that all creates a picture that is being currently used as a surrogate for tissue biopsy.
Okay, so but in Japan, they believe that they need to have a tissue biopsy, which means they go in and take a little snip out of the lung somehow and bring that tissue out and put it under the microscope?
So at certain centers in Japan, it is common. At certain centers in the U.S., you do find a clinician who's also...
Amy's on a cell phone, so I think we're having a little bit technical difficulty. Go ahead. Say that again, please.
At certain centers in the U.S. and at certain centers in Japan, there's a sense of, certain clinicians just feel strongly about getting a biopsy. And based on their training or cultural norms, and they do accept very rare exception in the U.S., but more commonly in Japan, as I understand it, we'll get early stage biopsies, and they'll go in and they'll take a wedge of a couple wedges or one wedge of lung tissue.
Right, and so depending on the patient's health status, that may or may not be particularly dangerous.
I think it's the risk, there is not a uniform standard right now in the world for this, but a lot of people just, do their own, clinicians will do their own risk-benefit calculus and decide over the risk that they're going to get a wrong diagnosis, they'll weigh that against, what from their experience have they seen, patients suffer with the biopsy. In any field, you just get people who practice more conservatively, people who, it's more personal. I think it's more individual than you might think.
Right. So from an academic perspective, it would be very interesting to have samples of tissue from, as you say, early on in the disease versus late in the disease, and sort of see what's the cell progression that we can observe that way. But of course, the physician is also looking at what is this going to cost the patient and what's the benefit to the patient? How might this change the way we're going to treat the patient, or would it make them feel better against the pain of the procedure and the risks of the anesthesia or whatever that may be involved?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Very well put. Yep, exactly.
Okay, let me ask you another question, because we've focused on drug development, which is, of course, critical, and that's where the long-term gains are going to be. But meanwhile, in parallel with that, are there improvements in management? Is there anything that can be done? Obviously, it's been 3 years, and you're still breathing, thank God. So, so there must be some better ways to manage things along the path.
Well, I wish that I could attribute I wish I could attribute some insights into management to the fact that I'm still breathing. But I think that, unfortunately, I think we aren't as far as we would like in understanding what lifestyle issues or other things might help to preserve lung function. I think since only women get LAM, one of the suspicions has been that estrogen plays some role in the progression. It's not a clear-cut role, because there are patient cohorts who have had, surgical or chemical removal of their ovaries, and yet the disease will progress anyway. So it's not so simple turning off estrogen, but there is some belief that perhaps, not in all cases, but perhaps the sustained estrogen levels during pregnancy can accelerate the disease. And so in my case, I think the number one, I also think that it's often overlooked, but I think exercise, and getting blood flowing throughout the lungs, is a really critical thing that can have potentially therapeutic, stability or sustaining effects. I think that avoiding, you know, it's not clear that avoiding estrogen-rich foods in your diet is going to make a big difference, but the pregnancy issue comes up a lot. And so what I did in my case is my husband and I, we, instead of becoming pregnant, we had a really wonderful woman carry my husband and my biological material for 9 months, and we have a beautiful daughter named Charlotte, and she's now two.
Great.
So that was one way of avoiding.
Yeah, it is. But if one of the things that has come out in some of the nutrition discussions we've had here is that there's a tremendous amount of estrogen in the normal American diet these days, with the soy that's added to everything and the hormones that are injected into cows and chickens.
So, absolutely.
What kinds of things do you do to try to avoid estrogen in the food supply?
Well, so the question is, you're absolutely right. You know, if you go and shop at a quote-unquote healthy food store these days, you'll find that the healthy protein is soy, which as a healthy person with a potentially estrogen-sensitive disease isn't perhaps so healthy. So it's not clear if this is how much of an impact it has, but again, avoiding soy and tofu is something that I do in case, just in case it helps. I think there's a new, some new information about the plastic bottles. I think about this a lot with a young child who's a girl. You know, I think about being careful, in her diet, just to make sure she's not drinking from the plastic bottles all the time, sitting in the sun and then drinking those, because I understand they degrade into some estrogen-related molecules. So I think, I wish I could have more control through diet. I think that it's not so clear from the literature that I've been exposed to what you can do other than, I think exercise really also helps to even out your levels. I'm curious to learn more about what you've learned.
Yeah, well, it's always different for each condition, but I think the bottom line that I'm learning for a lot of diseases is to try to eat healthy and avoid some of the all additives.
Yeah.
And so eating organic foods and trying to minimize the amount of soy, I think for everybody to know when you're taking in soy and not just eat it blindly in every prepared food there is on the shelves these days, that there's nothing really wrong with soy, but it does have this plant source of estrogen that we need to be mindful of and not just overuse it. And stress control, exercise, and just learning how, making sure that you get enough sleep is the other thing, because that's your body's self-repair time. And those guidelines, I'm finding, are pretty much applicable across the board.
Those make a lot of sense, and they really resonate. We oftentimes try and learn from patients, like patients who are doing well, whose disease is quote-unquote stable. You know, the first thing you want to do is, what are you doing or what are you not doing? And the sites like LAMSITE is going to help us with that. So a way of sort of looking across patients to see what they have in common in an easy way that doesn't require years and years of research or cost a lot of money.
But at the same time, we don't want to stop the research, because ultimately that is, of course, where the answer lies.
Oh, absolutely. So, no, they're not mutually exclusive whatsoever. And, I'm in awe of what you do and your contributions.
We decided early on, this was, of course, in 1993 when we first started, and we said, realistically, a drug to stop VHL is 20, 30 years away, and here we are almost 20 years later, and it's still, not around the corner, but that we meanwhile, there were a lot of people dealing with a lot of tumors, and we needed better ways of dealing with tumors surgically or whatever the treatment modality would be, and if possible, to slow down the progression. So we've put focus on all three.
Right. They're definitely not mutually exclusive. And you want to also bring in, you know, the self-healing literature without disregarding the more Western conventional approaches to research.
Right.
On that front, I just one little plug for, you know, just thinking in terms of business models and how nonprofits are increasingly just really doing such creative things to be patient-centered, you know, and work with both fee-for-service organizations to get work done more efficiently, to partner with academic labs and institutions to do what they do best. But being creative and being flexible is just, you know, there are lots of great models out there, and I think that there's some exciting faster pathways towards more concrete gains out there, and I'm excited. I'm excited to see what happens within our lifetimes.
Yes, for sure.
And to be part of it.
Amy, we have one question from the chat room. Has any LAM patient ever done a heavy metal body burden test?
Interestingly, I've heard of this test, and to my knowledge, no. But LAM site, this place where patients can share what they've learned on their own journeys, and when they've done off-label drugs or when they've done tests like this, even if patients have done it, if you don't have a place, you know, the infrastructure to capture that information, we would never know and we could never learn from it. So it's a great question, and the issue is now, you know, capturing all the amazing things that patients do in the absence of a therapy to try and slow or stop their disease or learn about what's gone wrong. So that's a fantastic question, and you know, and it makes a lot of sense.
Right, and so Chinese medicine, acupuncture, acupressure, all of these things, you know, try it and share your results with people so that we can learn from it, because if something begins to look promising, as you say, we could try to assemble 40, 50 people who've tried that and look at their results.
Yeah, and to be scientific, so it's not saying, you know, be anecdotal and we'll be satisfied, but you know, in science, it's common to do hypothesis generation, and if we can get some anecdotes, the more anecdotes we have, the more powerful anecdotes become, and then we can look at them very scientifically. Absolutely, you know, we've got to get the data first, so
right.
So share your experiences, and if you want to learn more about LAM, you can go to www.curelam.org. And send us your insights, your comments, your own stories.
That's great. We have about 2 minutes left, so let's repeat that: www.curelam.org. And you also have a website, lamtreatmentalliance.org.
That's the same. Yeah, it's the same site. A little easier to remember as curelam.org.
Oh, okay.
But it's
okay. Great.
And then
you mentioned LAM site also.
Right, LAM site. You can so www.lamsite.org, and it's a pilot. It's still the pilot phase, and it will be a pilot just until for another month, and then the look and feel will change, and we'll scale up a bit. But for now, you know, again, feel free to have a look around and send your comments and questions. But this is a work in progress, and it's a great partnership with the MIT Media Lab, very, very much in their own right committed to helping with the technologies that can help accelerate rare disease research.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for being with us today. This has been really wonderful. And let's remind everybody, too, to go to powerfulpatient.org. There will be a handout that goes with this show, and we'll put in there, we'll write down in there the various websites that we've been talking about, so you don't have to scribble all your notes. But we hope that if anybody out there is dealing with LAM, that you do well, and please, please do get in touch with Amy and help compile your experiences along with those of other women, and hopefully we're going to find a cure for this in time for Amy and for all of you.
Oh, Joyce, so much for having me.
This has been great, Amy. Thank you so much, and congratulations on all the progress you've made, and I hope it bears even better fruit soon.
Thank you, Joyce, and keep up the good work to all of you, and especially to Joyce. This is a team sport. It takes a village.
For sure. Anybody with a rare disease, you can see the power of getting together. I think that's one of the things Amy and I want everybody to know. Whatever the rare disease is that you and your loved ones are dealing with, there are folks out there who are on the same path. Get together and create some solutions.
So, absolutely.
Thanks so much, everybody, and we'll see you next week. And meanwhile, be well and be a powerful patient.